The Farallon Islands, 30 miles out into the Pacific Ocean from the Golden Gate, were known as the Islands of the Dead to the native Miwok who saw them from the shores of the mainland. They seemed to float on the horizon, sometimes invisible even on a clear day. Other times, they seem unusually close, like they are moving towards us. Greetings, I am Suzanne Lang, and this is KRCB's A Novel Idea. The Farallon Islands are the setting of Abby Jeanney's suspenseful novel, The Lightkeepers, and you'll hear our conversation in just a minute. At the southeastern edge of California, there's another intriguing setting, the Inland Empire, where nature and civilization collide. And that is explored in visual artist Louis DeSoto's memoir with photographs, Empire. I recently spoke with DeSoto in his Napa, California studio. When I encountered DeSoto's book, Empire, I had to meet the person behind it. The book captures an essence to a part of California that I have sought to understand. Southern California and the Inland Empire, an area of so many people and cars in the midst of that enormous natural landscape of mountains and desert. So it's very big nature in very big California today. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. The remote Farallon Islands have been visited by humans for hundreds of years and exploited for their abundant wildlife for as long. Seals were killed for meat and fur until their populations were decimated, and seabirds were robbed of their eggs at the staggering number of 1 million eggs per month during the mid-1800s. The impacts of humans are still being unraveled there. In 1909, Teddy Roosevelt signed an executive order to protect the islands, and in 1969, the Farallon Islands were designated part of the National Wildlife Refuge, and today host one of the largest seabird colonies on the planet. The only human inhabitants of the islands are biologists and researchers. These turbulent and mysterious Farallon Islands, it's the setting of The Lightkeepers, Abby Jeanney's recently published novel, which follows her book of short stories, The Last Animal. Miranda, the main character, is a photographer and travels there to spend a year documenting the place. The people and wilds she encounters are as challenging as her own experience of lifelong grief. Abby Jeanney and I sat down to talk about her book and her own life as a writer, and here is that conversation. Your book is The Lightkeepers, and what attracted me to want to read the book and to talk to you was its setting of the Farallon Islands, these spectral islands off the coast of California that, for those of us who live in California, some may never have even seen them. Mm-hmm. They seem to rise and move. And what drew you to have that be the setting of this book?
I had never seen them. I'm a Midwesterner born and bred. I was, you know, raised in Chicago and have really never lived far from there. But I knew I wanted to write a mystery, and I knew I wanted to write a mystery that was enclosed in a, you know, specific location where there could be a suspicious death, and it had to be one of the people who were in that location. And that's hard to do in this day and age. So I had this mystery in my mind, and I also love to write about the natural world. And then I bumped into a memoir called The Devil's Teeth, written by Susan Casey. And I learned about the islands for the first time, and I was so struck. First of all, they're the perfect setting for, you know, a cozy mystery, but they also are just such a remarkable hub for all kinds of marine life. And I was blown away, and I was inspired, and I began to research fanatically, and I was drawn in and just never let go until the book was finished.
And the book is a mystery, yet it is steeped in nature. And in fact, you segment the book into talking about bird time or bird season, seals, whales. And with what is happening and happened to all of these species that are now thriving, including the unnatural ones of the mice, it seems like it's also a timely book as well to bring that in.
To bring in ecological awareness. And yeah, I always want to write about climate change and my environmental devastation and, you know, animals that are on the precipice of becoming endangered or extinct. But I don't want to look right at those ideas too much in my work because it's terrifying and it's disturbing. And I also think it's a hard sell to get people to read about that. So I prefer to write in ways that celebrate nature and celebrate ecological revival and celebrate our relationship to nature. And in that way, I hope to do a little bit to help the environment and help places like the Farallon Islands, which are so remarkable in the work that they're doing.
The main character in the book, and as you say, it's set on these islands, and there's a limited amount of characters in the book and on staying out there on the island. And it is told through the voice of Miranda, your main character. And I was struck by her name being Miranda and Miranda in the Tempest and that setting of also being on an island. And even though I think some of the characters like Prospero and Galen maybe are not exactly alike, but there are similarities. So was that conscious on your part? There must have been a certain amount of that. But can you tell us a little bit about what drove you in that direction?
Yes. I'm so happy that you said that because I was definitely aware of that in writing it. I love The Tempest and I love the story of Miranda. And yes, I think Galen, who's the sort of head of the islands in the book, is very much a Prospero character. He knows everything that happens there. He's aware of all of these things which, you know, that happen in the natural world and in the human world.
And he even has his book.
Yes. Yes, he has his little magical book that he writes in. He knows more sometimes than Miranda does, even though she's our anchor. But I love The Tempest in part because it is a violent book, even though, or play, even though you don't really see that. I mean, there's Caliban, who's this dangerous character who has attacked Miranda. His relationship to Prospero is very strange. His relationship to Miranda is very strange. The play kind of skirts around those things, but I was interested in exploring them. And I'm also just fascinated by Miranda as this kind of wide-eyed ingenue who sees and yet doesn't see. And I wanted my Miranda to be a little bit like that. I mean, not to compare oneself to Shakespeare, but I like the idea of someone who is aware and is not aware at the same time. And I was exploring that.
And I will say it didn't strike me right away. And so I think then that is kind of a successful employment where we don't have that consciousness all the time, but there is something there.
Yay!
And Miranda, though that's her name, her compatriots on the island call her Melissa, call mm-hmm. her Mel, call her Mouse Girl. And she doesn't correct them or assert herself and say, I am Miranda. And it seems like that in itself is partly her journey through the book.
Yeah, I think that's true. I wanted to explore identity in many ways, and you know, what's in a name? And my editor and I worked extensively to create a narrator who may or may not be reliable. And so that was one of the things that we thought about was, what does it mean to be called by a name that is not your name? What does it mean to be nicknamed? What does it mean to assert your own identity? What does it mean to be interested in being an identity that is not your own? So I'm glad that you were interested in that too.
And the book is told through her voice as a ongoing kind of narrative with her mother, who is deceased. And it's something she has done through her life, is write to her mother. Mm-hmm. And one would think that that was a deep self-reflection, but in some ways it was a self-deflection.
Yes, I think so. I was interested when I wrote the short story collection, The Last Animal, and when I wrote that, I knew that I was writing stories that were linked, that were about the natural world, but not until I began to read reviews of the collection did I learn that I was also writing about grief and loss and people who disappear. I managed to write a short story collection that kind of has that as a theme without really knowing that I was doing that. And so when I began to write The Lightkeepers, I thought, okay, I'm going to address this directly. What does it mean to have someone disappear? What does it mean to lose someone who is so profoundly important to you? And I was interested in what it would mean for Miranda to write these letters to her mother, knowing and not knowing herself through that process, you know, because a letter, you know, she's a photographer, and a letter is like a photograph in that you say only what you want to say and you show only what you want to show. You can crop the frame to keep certain things out of it, and you can stop the letter at a certain point to keep certain things out of it. So even though she's narrating her life through letters, even though she's taking photographs, she still may not know the truth of her own circumstances. She still may not be telling us the truth of her own circumstances.
And she is a photographer, as you mentioned, and she uses photography and does reflect upon it as a lens for herself, or a filter mm-hmm. from direct experience. And there's an episode in the book where she goes out on a boat and does not have her camera and has to experience the whale, maybe, was
yes.
it? Directly.
Yes. Yes, when I began to write her as a nature photographer, it was mostly I wanted her to be on the islands, and I didn't want her to be a biologist. Most of the people who live there are naturalists, biologists. They're specialists in animals and flora and fauna. And I didn't want her to be of that group. I wanted her to be an outsider. So the nature photography arose initially because it was her reason for going there. But I began to research photography, and I began to research what it must be like to be a photographer. And the more I did, the more I knew her. And the more I began to understand her mind. And yes, that episode where she goes out with a whale specialist to see the whales, and doesn't have her camera and doesn't have that, I think it's an intermediate shield in between her and this sort of raw wildness of this place. I thought that was, that's an interesting moment for her.
Yes, and also there an interesting moment for her, a pivotal moment for her. And we don't want to give too much of the plot details away, but was when she decided to be in one of the photographs. And perhaps that was her greatest moment of self-awareness.
Yeah. Yeah, again, no spoilers, but the moment of great transgression where she crosses to the other side of the camera and maybe sees herself through the lens of her own camera in a way she can't see herself in life.
Yes. Yes, though the others around her could see her fairly well. I found the book had a real supernatural kind of edginess to it. Mm. So there, it is a mystery, But there are times when, as the reader, we're not sure what the mystery is. And there are, and I don't want to give too much away because I think that it's an unfolding that the reader should experience. But I found that you did a great job of mixing that kind of mystery of what is going on here. And even there seemed to be ghosts.
Yes. Well, thank you. That's such a relief. I think that was the hardest thing, was creating a mystery. You never know how something you create is going to seem to the reader. You never know if it's the right amount of tension, if it's too much, if it's too little, if the reader's ahead of you in terms of the discovery. It's such a delicate balance. So I'm delighted to hear that it worked for you. Oh, what was the last thing you said? Something important.
Ghosts.
Yes, ghosts. Well, that's in the book, The Devil's Teeth. There is famously a ghost on the island that has been seen wandering through the cabin. And so clearly the islands in my book are not the real Farallon Islands. I mean, you know, the biologist won't really try to murder you. And, you know, I've stretched the truth in many places. Yet it's based in many concrete details and in reality of that place, because that place, I mean, it's stranger than fiction. I couldn't make up things as amazing as that. And there is a ghost. So the ghost is in the book.
And for the reader, it is an interesting navigation of where is this going? And I think that for readers, that is why we read, not to know what's going to happen next. I regret to say I have not read your book of stories, The Last Animal, but it seems that you have a story in that book that involves an octopus.
Yes.
And there's an octopus in this book too. So perhaps you've not been to the Farallon Islands, but do you have experience with octopi?
When I was a little girl, I grew up in Chicago, and my favorite place in the world was the Shedd Aquarium, which is a remarkable aquarium. And there is an octopus there. And, you know, I just spent such a long time standing outside the octopus tank. So it kind of wove itself into my subconscious, I think. But then I was in grad school, and I remember one day I found myself at the public library, and I took down a book by Jacques Cousteau about octopus and squid, and I read it the entire thing cover to cover without knowing I was doing research. I just was like, I feel compelled to do this. And later that day, I went home and I began writing Captivity, which is the story about an octopus. And that was how the short story collection began, with that octopus and with that story. And I knew so much about them. They're so interesting, and not all of my research made it into that story. And so when I learned that there were octopuses on the islands as well, I was like, aha, I can put in some things that I know. But I also have to say, I've become someone that people forward octopus articles to me, and I have octopus Christmas ornaments, and it's become my spirit animal somehow. So I know a lot about them, partly because I'm interested and partly because I'm known for them now. You know, my first book had an octopus on the cover, and it's all been downhill from there.
I think that Cousteau book makes a cameo appearance.
Yes.
In your book.
It does. Good memory. Yeah, it's called The Soft Intelligence. It's a wonderful, if you're interested in invertebrates, it's wonderful.
I found the way you, and this is an example of it, when you, this octopus, Oliver, was it named Oliver?
Yes.
had a moodiness. It was in captivity, and it seemed to be something Miranda, our main character, was transfixed by. And even if we didn't always know what she was thinking about it, it seemed like the octopus seemed to hold a significance in her psyche, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. The octopus is an outlier in the book. you know, the researchers on the islands don't tamper with nature. You know, they're there to observe it and to, you know, tag the sharks. It's the most interference they do. They don't put chum in the water. They don't take the animals as pets. If an animal is injured, they don't, you know, they can't intervene. It's just, it's, they're there to document. But they do in the book take an octopus as a pet, which is, I think, probably something that they would not do in real life. But I'm crazy about them. And I wanted there to be one in the book. And you're not going to have an experience with them in the wild. I mean, if you dive off the islands, there could be 10 octopuses in the water around you. You would never know. So I sort of broke the rules a little bit there to bring the octopus into Miranda's life. And it's interesting. It sounds like for you, the octopus was kind of like a mood ring.
It was. Mm-hmm. And it literally was. And it added to a certain creepiness of maybe because they of the way they move and the way their bodies are.
They're so alien,
mm-hmm. but they have a consciousness that is so demonstrated, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So, and you mentioned you had just come from Point Reyes. Did you see any elephant seals while you were out
there? Yes. I was staying with family friends at Point Reyes Station, and we traveled to Drake's Beach. Mm-hmm. So we saw some elephant seals. They told us we might see whales. I did not get my hopes up because I knew that was unlikely, and it was. We didn't. But we did see that we saw the distant shapes on the shoreline. And then this morning we got up early and went to a different peak, which of course I'm not going to remember the name of, and actually saw the Farallon Islands, and that was the first time I've ever seen them in life. It was a magical, bizarre thing to see a place that I've been so many times in my imagination.
That must have been somehow a cap, a completion to mm-hmm. to your writing, and perhaps even a confirmation. They exist, and I think I got it right.
Yes, I hope so. I almost chose to create a fictional island chain because I didn't want to write a murder mystery about a place where real, wonderful people work and live. But the Farallons, they're so remarkable, and I couldn't have created anything as wonderful as they are. So yes, it was amazing to see them, and they're so spooky. You know, they were floating in this bath of clouds, and they hardly looked anchored to the world. I mean, it looked like, they looked like a dream.
And there's sometimes you just can't see them at all.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you feel like you're looking at the horizon, but they are not there. And other times it seems like they've moved.
Yeah, that's what happened yesterday. We looked outside, the horizon seemed absolutely clear, and they weren't there. They were somewhere else.
Yes, yes. And the sharks, it seemed like there was also this just forebodingness created by the presence of sharks in the water, and your descriptions of blood on the water and even the smell of it. And I wonder, in your life, when you're not writing, are you out hiking? Or do you enjoy nature? Because it's so imbued in your work.
I do enjoy nature. I think being from the Midwest and being from Chicago, I mean, Chicago, people don't, if you haven't grown up there or lived there or been there very much, you don't realize the extent to which Chicago is a coastal city. The lake is, it's, you smell it on the air, it changes the weather, it's this constant presence. And in the Midwest, the seasons are so extreme. I mean, right now in California, it's 70 degrees, in Chicago, I think it's 20, and that's pretty warm for right now. You know, the seasons are something you have to survive. So there's a way that if you live there, you are in contact with nature. You can't forget about it. You can't forget that it's something that, again, you have to survive, that it's not a background. It's right there with you. But I am a homebody. I love to be in my place. And I love to write about places I have not been. I think I love to do enough research that I know I'm getting it right. and then to let my imagination create the rest and kind of travel there in my mind and create the place a little bit for myself. And never go there in life. That's fine with me. And I loved the time that I spent on the islands in my book. And I remember when I was really, really done with it and I'd sent the final draft to my editor, I thought, oh, I never get to go back there again. And I was sad, but I was also at peace with that. And one of the researchers actually reached out to me when he learned that I was coming to California to ask if I would be interested in taking a trip, at least to see them up close. And I honestly, I didn't want to go. I know them in the way that I know them, and I don't think I want to know them maybe the way they really are.
And it sounds like in your book of short stories that you are also kind of using the natural world to describe ourselves as human beings. And this book did have a lot to do with loss, with mourning, with maybe even the inability to grieve or to understand grief. And earlier you just said that that was something maybe you weren't quite aware you were doing.
I think that there are sort of story archetypes that speak to people, to writers. And sometimes you can't choose what archetype speaks to you. And so, you know, both my parents are living and I have a wonderful relationship with them. But the story of a woman who had lost her mother, I was able to write about my own life through the archetype of that story in a way that was really meaningful for me. I sometimes think that story logic is like dream logic. You know, symbols don't mean what they might mean in real life, but they have intense meaning for the writer, and then the reader may interpret them differently because their symbols may mean different things in a different mind. So yeah, the story of grief and loss doesn't come in a straight line from my own life, but I can see where it comes from and I see why it's a story that I needed to tell.
I noticed that you attended the Iowa Writers Workshop, and sorry, it seems like in this past year, several authors I've talked to have. So, and to my regular listeners, I'm going to ask your indulgence on this because, yes, I'm going to ask Abby about that experience, about it seems like for writers, there are more and more writing programs. And if you could address that from the perspective of maybe advising other writers.
For me, in terms of thinking about an MFA, I began my writing as an intuitive and instinctive writer. I would create a story and I would follow my instincts and then I would be done with it and I would think, and now what? I have no idea. I'll make another story. So I didn't have any idea how to revise, how to edit, how to look at my own work critically. And so for me, grad school was incredibly informative because I learned that skill. But it also came with a pretty severe cost, which was for 3 years after graduating, I didn't write at all because I'd learned how to revise and edit, and I didn't know how to turn that off and return to that joyful, creative state of writing without feeling that editor standing over my shoulder. So I'd write a sentence and the editor would go, well, that's terrible. And you can't create anything that way. But I know people who left grad school and never wrote again. And I think that's probably part of why. And I know other people who didn't go to grad school and learn that skill on their own. So I always hesitate to give anyone advice except to say, don't go to grad school if you go into debt doing it, especially for writing. You know, if you can find a way, if you can get a fellowship, if you can get a teaching fellowship, you know, then it's a wonderful way to go and experience art and be in a writerly community. But you're never going to make $1 million being a writer. So
don't go into debt doing it.
Yes.
I want to encourage our listeners and readers to pick up The Lightkeepers by Abby Janey. And is it The Last Animal?
Mm-hmm.
Is the series of stories. Thank you so much for coming into the station today, and I'm so glad that you got to see the islands.
Me too.
The beautiful Farallon Islands and visit this beautiful part of California. Mm. And I want to encourage you and to come back again.
Thank you so much. It's been a delight.
I've been talking with Abby Jeanney, and her book set way out on the Farallon Islands is The Lightkeepers. We also mentioned her book of short stories, The Last Animal. Both titles are released by Counterpoint Press. We'll take a short break, and when we return, we'll explore a book from another California literary treasure, Heyday Books. And that book is Louis De Soto's Empire. I'm Suzanne Lang. It's a novel idea.
Shoulder to shoulder, we fight battles, my friend. Wins and losses, we lose count in the end. Constantly crossing a line that's so narrow and fine between winning fulfillment and losing your soul. In your heart of hearts, you know it's true. In your heart of hearts, you'll still be you. No matter how self-righteous or holy thou art, you will always know better in your heart of hearts.
Visual artist Louis De Soto grew up in San Bernardino, and his book, Empire, recently released by Heyday Books, explores the part of California known as the Inland Empire, as well as his Kaweah ancestral homeland near Palm Springs. The arresting photographs in the book are also part of a show that just closed at the Fullerton Museum of Art in San Bernardino. The essays in the book are candid and reveal his personal emergence as an artist and the depth of his cultural perceptions. I met him at his studio in Napa, California. Here is our conversation. This book, Empire, deals with a part of our state. It's this incredibly dynamic geologic area,
right,
that is so defined. It's geologic processes you could almost see happening.
But you can see the beginning of the San Andreas Fault, particularly when you're up in Joshua Tree at the lookout, looking west between the San Jacinto Mountains and the San Bernardino Mountains. You can see it rise up out of the ground like a spine.
And we can also see these massive industrial areas and housing developments and discarded industrial areas, and there's such a massive humanity down there, mm-hmm. often built in places, arroyos, for instance. Why is a housing development built in an arroyo? So when I've visited down there, there's always this kind of dissonance of people and nature. But you grew up there, and you're writing about it, and your photographs about it relay different information.
People can be really defensive about the area because it's got it has a bad reputation. San Bernardino in particular, which is where I grew up, it's a crime-ridden city, the foreclosure capital of the United States for a while. It's had all kinds of internal city problems, which have related to how it's developed. For instance, the downtown core has completely fallen apart. And if you compare it to Riverside, to see the downtown core has completely been built up. So politics and things like that get in the way of its redemption, I would say. But on the other hand, you have, on these clear days, these beautiful, majestic mountains, which kind of wipe out the sense of it's a place where nothing's happening or a place that's falling apart. And I had to deal with that when I was a child. I would feel like I was sort of at the beginning of the decay as a child. The San Bernardino Valley was a huge area of agricultural invention, and the Redlands area in particular was thought of as like the capital of the Orange Empire. So citrus was so important to the economy of the United States at the time. So there's a lot of money in the area, Riverside and San Bernardino and Redlands in particular. But the money drained out as the Cold War swung into full, I don't know what you call, nuclear threat mode. And Kaiser Steel, which was placed in Fontana, was put there to create material for World War II and then material for the Cold War. And a lot of aerospace companies built up around that. San Bernardino had an Air Force base, which is no longer in service. And so when I was growing up, it was the loss of that Orange Empire, along with that destruction, was a loss of small businesses, a loss of self-determination. When the freeways were put in, for instance, the Latino community, which was along Baseline and Mount Vernon, was passed by. There was no off-ramp for that area. So the whole area just started falling into disrepair. All that stuff was invisible. I could take a picture of it, but it remained out of reach, so I had to start writing. And I found that along with the historical information and the, I guess you'd call it just the plain statistics of the place, I had to mix in the transitional experiences that I was experiencing when I was, you know, a teenager or a child and so on.
And I hope that this book leads readers and interested people into your visual art. I regret to say I wasn't highly familiar with it and was excited to discover some of that.
Yeah, thank you.
And In the foreword of the book, some of your process is discussed, and I wondered if you could describe that process. It seems like there's a digital element to the composition.
Sure, I can talk about that.
I'm kind of curious about that.
There's two kinds of pictures in the book. I use two different cameras. One camera I use primarily for taking what people would recognize as a picture in the normal sense. You point it at something, you push the shutter, and then you have to deal with all the other things later digitally and so on to get prints out of it. The long panoramas started actually in Napa when I moved here from San Francisco in 2000. I loved the landscape, and it reminded me so much of the agricultural landscape that I grew up in. So I felt like I had, in a way, I had come home by moving farther north, away from San Francisco. You know, it has dry summers and there are palm trees up here. There's just, we have orange tree on the property, you know. I decided I want to photograph some vineyards. Particularly, I liked, after one cycle, seeing how the vineyards were cared for, how they were sort of architectural in a way. And then how they, you know, how the vines were cut, how the vines were kept out of the way of the sunlight hitting the grapes, and all the sort of science of it. So I started working with the camera that I used to use, which was a medium format film camera. And I just didn't like anything. Number one, vineyards lay flat to the land, and my 2.25 camera was square format. So I was just getting these sort of pictures divided in half visually. And then they tended to look all the same because the view, when stepping back, you lost the detail and the sort of sparkling nature of the vineyards. So a friend of mine in LA was showing me his pictures and I was shocked by them. They were so beautiful and they were so detailed. And I thought he must have one of these $100,000 digital camera backs that he puts on a 4x5 view camera. And he sheepishly said, "No, I don't." And he was a little reluctant to tell me his secret. He was using a software that took many small pictures and then put them together, kind of like the NASA software they use when a satellite goes around a planet, or the Mars probe takes many, many small pictures and then puts them together. And it's made by a French company. So I tried that, and I just loved it because I could get extremely, extremely detailed pictures of foreground and background. The problem with them was that they were distorted. A lot of people now can take panoramas with their phones, right? And when you do that, the thing that's closest to you balloons forward, and the things that are farther away kind of shrink away, and it looks lensy, as they would say in the parlance. And I didn't like that, so I used Photoshop to sort of squeeze the center, make it shallower, and I would pull out the edges to create an effect that I would call a drive-by, meaning that when you're driving on a freeway or a road and you're looking out the window of the landscape, you know, your side window, the parallelity of what you're looking at remains. It follows it along. So the pictures I was able to take had that sense of feeling like you could see the whole vineyard from one spot equally in detail, where the left and right sides were not far away, but they were equal to the center side. So it's a distortion, but it looks very, very natural because our eyes basically do the same thing that this program does. We're talking together in this room, right? And I'm looking around, I'm seeing you, I look back, I look out the window. And then in my mind, I create a picture of where we are. It's not a snapshot. It's not a single frame. And so to me, these kinds of images feel more natural to our own way of seeing. So I just moved that over to the Inland Empire because it was helping me do the same thing. It was helping me see connecting parts of the landscape that were actually far apart from one another. And I didn't have to take fragments and then try to connect them in a series. What I could do is I could take 100 pictures, put them all together, and then make very, very large prints. So what you can do is stand right up to them and you can access the detail and move from one part to the other. One of the joys of being a photographer with old technology is looking through a large format camera and looking at the ground glass with a hood over your head, because the world is miniaturized and it's super sharp, super beautiful color. It's a magical world in there. It's upside down and backwards, so your brain has to kind of rethink how composition works and so on. But I found that I was getting that same kind of thrill by looking at the prints. The prints had that amount of detail that I found. It gave me the quality I wanted in the pictures. And by distorting them back to this idea of driving by and looking at a landscape through a car window, it gave me the sense of space that I was looking for, which I couldn't get before.
You mentioned coming back to photography, and you've just mentioned a car window, and it seems like automobiles run through your work quite a bit and through your life quite a bit, starting from your father's Model A Ford.
Right. I mean, that was like the landscape of my childhood, playing with, I think a crescent wrench was what my dad gave me to play with, which was fascinating to look at and move around. He had a 1929 Model A Ford Roadster pickup that he had taken apart and was in the garage, and so he was reassembling it. Eventually, I got to drive it to high school. It was a very primitive car, and it made a kind of peculiar sound when the engine had a peculiar sound to it. And I enjoyed the archaic nature of it. But cars were always part of my father's obsession, and they just became part of mine.
And part of your art.
That's true. I have made three cars that are art-related as sculptures. A couple of them have shown, actually all three have shown in the Napa Valley. at the DeRosa and at Napa Valley Museum. And they've also shown back east in a few other places, including the Palm Springs Museum of Art. So I use the cars as metaphors because that's what they are. I've always been metaphors. They've been transportation pods, yes, but automobiles have been imbued in their design with certain cues about what it might mean to drive them. So it's not a mistake that bankers drove Cadillacs in the 60s and, you know, salesmen drove Buicks and so on. There was a kind of an identification with the self and related to that. And then when muscle cars came about, then there was this whole issue of being powerful and being male and being having agency over the world.
And it's how you explored your own landscape. And I think in your book you talk about it being peaceful and I think you might have used the term meditation.
Yes. When I got my Dodge, that was the early 70s, it wasn't like the Model A. The Model A, I could drive maybe 10 miles. It was kind of dangerous, and you're just not sure you would get there. You know, it could stop at any moment, and you might not have an idea why it stopped. But the Dodge let me drive all over the place, and so it was the first vehicle of independence that I experienced. So one of the first things I did, which is kind of funny, I drove to Pasadena to the Norton Simon collection because I wanted to see Impressionist paintings. You know, that really blew me away. And I noticed as I drove, I became kind of, I went into an alpha state, let's say, a state of incredible repose. And I added to that a sound system where I could play cassettes. And that allowed me to orchestrate what I was going to hear and what I was going to see. So if I was going to go up to Lake Arrowhead, for instance, I might put in a Soft Machine album. And it was kind of timed for me to experience certain things when certain parts of the album were playing. So I could even, you know, adjust what tracks came on when to get that experience. And so I used music and driving as a way of meditating, although I didn't know I was doing it at the time.
You are of Native American descent, Kawila?
It's Kawia.
Kawia.
But there's a lot of different Kawia bands because the bands are related to moieties or families in particular areas. So my grandmother grew up in the Agua Caliente area, Palm Springs. Then she moved to the Saboba, which is in San Jacinto. My father was born in Saboba Reservation. But there was a flash flood there, and I guess my father was 2 or 3 years old. This is my aunt's story. And then my father was carried out on top of my grandmother's head as she waded through these floodwaters, and they went to the other side of the mountains, to the east side, to the Agua Caliente, and stayed there. So he grew up on the Agua Caliente side.
You have a lovely remembrance in the book of going to one of the palm canyons with your dad, where he actually lived and now is a reserve.
Yeah, it's a reserve. It's part of the Agua Caliente tribe's reservation allocation. For many years, the federal government wanted to turn that area, Palm Canyon, into a national park. But eventually, the Bureau of Indian Affairs allowed the land to return to the families there. So my father grew up in Palm Canyon, or at the mouth of Palm Canyon. It's kind of hard to grow up in the canyon itself, because the canyon floods from time to time because the water flows down from the San Jacinto Mountains, the snow melts and so on. So we would do these sort of nostalgia tours, I would call them, where he would want to take me around and point to various things that weren't there anymore. So we'd say that that ruin of a little adobe ruin was where we, you know, where I lived, and I, you know, I'd climb up these rocks and, you know, do all of these particular things. So yeah, I felt like I felt connected to it. And with the help of my aunt, you know, got my BIA numbers. My father did not want to be identified as a Native American. He said that he wanted to be a man and he wanted to be free. And I think he felt that the family was an encumberment to his freedom. Because I asked him, why did you come back? Why did you, you know, get a land allotment and move? Because he was always poetically connected to the place. And he said, I want to be free.
Your father is a huge influence, as you express it in the book. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, it seems like your art is heavily influenced by him, either consciously or unconsciously, and that sense of freedom and also that sense of mechanization.
I think going along with that freedom was the idea of skill. That is, if you could make things, if you could fix things, you were independent of others. So he had woodworking skills. He was a mechanic. He could build things. And in fact, I thought about him because we're recording this in this little studio, which I built with the help of some friends and designed with the help of some friends. And all of those things that he taught me came into play when I was building this. And I would often think about that. Like, if I didn't know how to use a level or how to frame a building or any of those things, it would not exist. And so he was probably my biggest teacher. And he just approached everything like this. This needs to get done. What do I need to do it? What do I need to know? And he would figure it out and he would build it or fix it himself. And he was always, he was an exact person. He worked for the Air Force and the Navy. He was always in charge of inspecting things. So he always had these calipers and kinds of devices for measuring distance, length, and depth in his garage. And he would always take them out and, you know, make sure that it was no more than 10,000ths of an inch off. So that sort of made an impression, I think. He was also the emotional person in the family. So he was the one that had, he had the expression of emotion. My mother did not. My mother was a very, very reserved person. She was a very nervous person. And she didn't express her feelings very much. So my father sort of carried the emotional weight of the family, and he also carried the application of skills in the world.
Well, you do a fair degree of storytelling in this book, Empire, and there's so much more we can talk about or that I'm interested in talking about, and really it's that juxtaposition of nature and commerce, population. And growing up down there, you talk a lot about the Santa Ana winds and the asthma that you had, mm-hmm. and the pollution that was sometimes shrouding the very features around you. And you reflect on that a little bit in the book.
Yeah, the mountains were a sentinel. Number one, they were a sentinel of being able to breathe easier. The Kaiser steel plant and all the car exhaust, of course, was blown eastward in the late afternoon by the winds coming off the ocean through Los Angeles. And so there was a penetrating brown haze that covered everything. And it blocked the view of the mountains for the most part. And when it was at its most opaque was the most dangerous time for me in terms of my health. It's just very hard to to deal with all the lung irritation that that caused. That kind of controlled my life in a way, and I longed to, you know, get away from it. And then the Santa Ana winds would start, and they would blow everything out, and everything would be blown, I guess, into Palm Springs, I guess, into the Mojave Desert, or blown south into the Riverside, and then into Temecula and the valley. And it was wonderful. Everything sparkled. You could see things for, you know, hundreds of miles, really. And you could even drive up to the crest of Highway 18 and you could see the ocean. You could see the Catalina Islands. It was really magnificent. You saw at that moment that you lived in this sort of miracle place that was filled with beauty and energy and fascination. And then it would all get carpeted again with this brown haze. And when the steel plant was removed and sold to the Chinese, things started turning around. We also had pollution controls for automobiles in place. And every time I would visit my parents, it seemed like 50% of the time I could see the mountains. And then it was 60%, it was 70%. And then when I went down to photograph for the book, I rarely see these days where I couldn't see very far. And I would actually be excited by it, like, oh, good. I could only see like 3 or 4 miles. That will make a great photograph because it corresponded to my memories. But most of the pictures of the book show the mountains at some point and some in the background. And that was kind of an impossible occurrence when I was living there.
I wonder if you could give our listeners maybe some advice on how to themselves maybe visit the Inland Empire and have an experience of it that might be resonant of yours or see it in a way that is different.
There is an interesting thing that you can do. Number one, there is a website that Esri, the map making company, has made. And you can find pictures in the book, and then it gives you the exact latitude of where to go. Look and stand in the same exact spot where the photo was taken and see what it looks like, see what it feels like.
Luis DeSoto, thank you so much.
Thanks for talking to me. Thank you.
You've been listening to me talking with visual artist Luis DeSoto. Visit him online to get a sense of his work. He's got several installations you might visit in person if you're traveling around the West Coast, and you can find out where and when they are on his website. I'm Suzanne Lang, and want to remind you that all of our broadcasts are available at krcb.org. You can subscribe to them and listen anytime. We have production assistance from Sean Knight and Mark Prell. Our music was provided by Sonoma County's own The Farallones. Watch for them playing around the area. Uncle Lucius gave us his song, San Bernardino. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.
Head west, young man. What he heard him say. So he loaded up his six string and he rolled away. Thought about Frisco, wound up in West LA. They said San Bernardino's where the Joes play.